administration is behaving in a lawless way. So am I certain I'm going to be paid back? No, because they're not following the law. But I am certain that is the law.
The White House floats the possibility that some furloughed workers could be denied back pay when the government reopens.
For Wednesday, October 8th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. Ahead this hour, Germany's auto industry is in decline.
So instead, some German car manufacturers are making weapons.
Where are new markets? Well, government has committed a lot of new funding for defense. So it's very obvious for us to look to this market.
Plus, former FBI Director James Comey was in court today as a criminal defendant.
And the new movie Fairyland is set in 1970s San Francisco.
It's based on a memoir about a young girl who lives with her widowed gay father.
I could really relate to so much of what she was writing about.
Now news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Ryland Barton. An appeals court is allowing President Trump to federalize Oregon's National Guard for now, but a lower court order that blocked Trump from deploying Guard troops to Portland remains in effect. The rulings come from the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. President Trump says Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson should be arrested for, quote, failing to protect ICE agents. NPR's Sergio Martinez-Beltran reports.
Trump's comments on social media came after Mayor Johnson signed an executive order prohibiting Immigration and Customs Enforcement from using city-owned space to conduct operations. Mayor Johnson says this is Trump's mode of operating.
This is not the first time Trump has accused or insisted on a black man being arrested.
Hundreds of National Guard troops have been deployed to Chicago at Trump's behest, who has called the city a war zone, despite its homicide rates reaching their lowest levels since the 1960s. Johnson says he will fight what he calls Trump's attacks on his city via policy, in the courts, and in the streets. Sergio Martinez Beltran, NPR News, Chicago.
There's still no end in sight to the government shutdown. Federal worker union leaders are pushing Congress to do its job. Military troops are preparing to go without paychecks, and flight delays are happening nationwide. Republicans like House Speaker Mike Johnson are pushing to temporarily reopen the government.
We just need a stopgap measure to give us a little more time to get the job of Congress done. They refuse to do it because they're playing politics, and real Americans are paying the price for it.
House Democratic Leader Hakeem Jeffries says Republicans could reopen the government if they just agree to fund health insurance subsidies.
These extremists don't even want to show up to work when they're requiring hardworking federal employees to show up to work without pay because of the Republican shutdown.
Democratic and Republican-backed plans to fund the government both failed again today. The Federal Reserve's decision to cut interest rates last month was not quite the slam dunk that the voting tally might have suggested. NPR's Scott Horsley reports on newly released minutes from the Fed's September meeting.
All 12 voting members of the Fed's rate-setting committee voted to lower the Fed's benchmark interest rate last month. 11 voted for a quarter-point cut, which carried the day. The newest member of the committee, White House economist Stephen Miron, voted for a bigger half-point cut. Minutes reveal that a few Fed policymakers wanted to hold interest rates steady, or at least would have supported that position, out of concern over stubborn inflation. The central bank's walking a tightrope as it tries to both tamp down prices and prop up the sagging job market. Fed policymakers cast another vote on interest rates in 3 weeks, and thanks to the government shutdown, they may have to do so without the benefit of updated information on the job market or inflation. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
Wall Street got back to rising today. The S&P 500 climbed 0.6%, a day after snapping a 7-day winning streak. This is NPR. The U.S. Marshals say the last inmate who is still on the run after breaking out of a New Orleans jail in May has been caught. 10 men escaped from the jail after squeezing through a hole behind a toilet and scaling a barbed wire fence. The Nobel Prize for Chemistry has gone to three scientists who created new materials that can store energy and scrub toxins from air or water. NPR's John Hamilton has more.
In 1989, Richard Robson of the University of Melbourne, Australia, showed how to make molecular structures that resembled porous diamonds. But these structures, called metal organic frameworks, tended to collapse until two other scientists found better assembly methods. One of these scientists is Omar Yagi of the University of California, Berkeley. The other is Susumu Kitagawa of Kyoto University in Japan. Kitagawa told reporters that these new molecular structures could improve the heavy metal cylinders used to transport liquefied natural gas.
We can make this cylinder lighter and lighter. and easy to deliver.
The porous structures can also capture the carbon dioxide coming from power plants. John Hamilton, NPR News.
Joan Kennedy has died at age 89. She was the first wife of the late Senator Edward Kennedy, or Ted Kennedy. She endured the assassinations of her two brothers-in-law and stood by her husband through the scandals, as well as his failed 1980 run for president. The couple divorced in 1982. She worked for the mentally challenged and other causes, but also struggled with mental health issues and alcoholism herself for much of her life. This is NPR News. From Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org. And Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts.
Thanks for listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. It is 4:06. I'm Jennifer Barr. Support comes from L&M Fleet Supply, carrying a variety of products for your next outdoor adventure with 13 locations across the Northland. More at lmsupply.com. Clear tonight, lows 37 to 44, and increasing clouds tomorrow, highs 62 to 66. Looking ahead to Friday, mostly sunny, highs in the low to mid-60s. More news is next.
News. This is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Scott Detrow. It has been quite a week for federal workers caught in the middle of the government shutdown. Sunday, President Trump said mass layoffs were underway.
That's taking place right now, and it's all because of the Democrats.
Monday, White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt walked back those claims.
The president was referring to the hundreds of thousands of federal workers who have been furloughed as a result of this federal government shutdown, both here.
And yesterday, a new threat. Trump and other top Republicans raised doubts over whether those furloughed workers would get paid once the government reopens.
I would say it depends on who we're talking about. I can tell you this, the Democrats have put a lot of people in great risk and jeopardy, but it really depends on who you're talking about. But for the most part, we're going to take care of our people. There are some people that really don't deserve to be taken care of, and we'll take care of them in a different way.
NPR labor and workplace correspondent Andrea Hsu and political reporter Stephen Fowler join us now to help make sense of all of this. Hi to both of you.
Hi, Scott.
Hey there. Stephen, I want to start with you, and let's start with this idea that some federal workers would not get back pay once the shutdown ends. Where does this come from?
So, Scott, there's a law in the books that says after a shutdown, federal employees who were forced to work without pay and forced to not work because Congress couldn't fund the government, these employees get back pay. That law was signed in 2019 after the record 35-day funding lapse by then-President Trump. And here's what he said at the time.
I will make sure that all employees receive their back pay very quickly or as soon as possible. It'll happen fast.
Okay, that was then. He signed the bill into law. What's changed?
Well, Trump's second term has been all about finding different ways to have less federal government and fewer people working for it. So after the shutdown started last week, the Office of Management and Budget removed a line from its frequently asked questions that noted this back pay provision, and an internal draft memo was circulated with a contradictory view of the law. Now, this draft memo argues that the hundreds of thousands of furloughed employees who aren't deemed essential to the government functioning aren't guaranteed their paychecks either unless Congress explicitly says so.
Andrea, what are you hearing from workers and unions about this back pay issue?
Well, they're not buying this interpretation of the law. Many of these workers were around in 2019 when Congress passed the law, and they fully expect to get paid. And they tell me this is just another scare tactic.
A scare tactic to get Democrats to concede in the shutdown? Is that the thinking?
Yeah, and I spoke with Sarah Coburn about this. She's a longtime employee of the National Cancer Institute. And to be clear, she spoke with me in her personal capacity, not on behalf of the government. She believes the Trump administration is just going to do what it wants, shutdown or not. In fact, her agency has already gone through mass layoffs. Grants that she was overseeing have been cut. And this has happened even as lower court judges have found those moves illegal. So here's what she had to say about the new threat over back pay.
I believe this administration is behaving in a lawless way. So when I spoke to my husband before it happened, I said, am I certain I'm going to be paid back? No, because they're not following the law. But I am certain that is the law.
And Scott, it's not just federal workers and Democrats who are saying this. I mean, several budget experts I've spoken with say that the questions around back pay and some of the other proposals the White House is tying to the shutdown are misleading at best. Like Jessica Riedel with the center-right Manhattan Institute, she says, as one example, the constant threat of mass layoffs because of the shutdown just doesn't reflect the reality of how these reductions in force actually have to work or who ultimately makes those decisions.
It may be the case that we have more government employees at certain agencies than is necessary, but reduction in force decisions should be made based on long-term agency needs, not in response to a temporary shutdown.
So, Andrea, just to be clear, since we have been talking about this in so many different ways, about a week in, have there been any layoffs tied to the shutdown at this point?
Actually, no, not connected to the lapse in funding anyway. There have been layoffs last week at the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, but those had already been in the works. And federal employees have used this moment to point out that whatever layoffs happen now are really just an extension of what's been happening since Trump came back to office and launched his Department of Government Efficiency. I talked with Alexis Goldstein about this. She's with the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau and a member of the employees union there. She also spoke to me in her personal capacity. She is still working, still getting paid because her agency's funding does not come through annual appropriations from Congress. She says very little work is actually being done, and it's been like that since early this year when the Trump administration first tried to dismantle the CFPB. You know, for example, the agency is not monitoring the banks, which is what Congress created the CFPB to do after the 2008 financial crisis. Here's how she put it.
We're just very hamstrung or like frozen in an ice cube.
And Scott, we have asked the Trump administration for a response to this kind of criticism coming from federal employees. The White House spokeswoman, Abigail Jackson, sent a statement saying, President Trump was elected by a resounding majority of Americans to carry out the agenda he is implementing. And she said federal workers who are resisting the Trump agenda are working against the American people.
All right, so we're hearing all of these people who feel like their paychecks or their future employment has been tied up as negotiating tactics. Stephen, where do those negotiations actually stand? What, if anything, is happening right now?
Well, Republicans in Congress don't have enough votes in the Senate to reopen the government. They're not willing to negotiate with the Democrats so far, who want Republicans to extend health care subsidies for millions of Americans. Meanwhile, Trump and his Office of Management and Budget Director, Russ Vogt, have been trying a lot of different things over the last few weeks and have sent mixed messaging about their purpose. Some interpret it as a pressure campaign, while the administration says they're simply taking steps to mitigate spending in a shutdown. Those are things like terminating energy grants in places that didn't vote for Trump, holding up transit funding in Chicago and New York, and the constant threats to fire workers and or not pay them, which so far none of these things have panned out or moved the needle in this shutdown fight.
NPR's Stephen Fowler and Andrea Hsu, thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Fairyland is a new movie set in 1970s San Francisco. A young girl and her widowed gay father live a fun, unconventional life before the AIDS epidemic hits. As NPR's Mandalit Del Barco reports, the film was based on a memoir by Alicia Abbott that resonated with producer Sofia Coppola and director Andrew Durham.
In the city, 67 degrees at KFRC.
Steve Abbott moved to San Francisco after his wife died, a city where he was able to live freely as a poet and novelist, a gay man, and single dad. In the film, actor Scoot McNairy portrays Steve, who raises his daughter Alicia, played as a child by Nessa Doherty.
Dad, why do you only have boyfriends and never girlfriends?
Because your mother was my favorite girl, and I could never love another girl as much as I loved her.
Alicia grows up in a bohemian home with her dad and their roommates. They sometimes dress up in costumes to go to parties and poetry readings. Abbott wrote about this in her memoir, Fairyland.
I was a 10-year-old and I felt like anything was possible, and I loved rainbows and unicorns and Pegasus, and I just
thought the 80s were going to be this wonderful time, you know, infused with the soundtrack of Xanadu. It wasn't just a matter of being in my dad's world where a lot of gay men were feeling free for the first time, but San Francisco was also just a place for people to go if they didn't quite fit in where they came from and they wanted to experiment and try new things. And so there was a lot of found family in San Francisco.
After reading Abbott's memoir, writer-director Sofia Coppola decided to produce it as a film. She says the story reminded her in some ways of her own childhood in San Francisco, where she grew up the daughter of legendary filmmaker Francis Ford Coppola.
We lived in an old Victorian house, and my dad had all these European filmmakers and eccentric artists coming through. And so this world, the creative people in San Francisco at that time, just this kind of bohemian, eccentric. And it was really fun, interesting crowd. So I was just touched by her story, and I felt like it could be a movie. I thought about one of my favorite movies is Paper Moon, and it just reminded me of this kind of buddy movie with a father and a daughter.
As a teen, Alicia is played by actress Emilia Jones.
How did I raise such a normal girl? Huh? Where did I screw up?
You really want me to go down the list? Because we'll probably miss the party.
To make the cinematic version of Fairyland, Coppola turned to her friend and collaborator Andrew Durham. The photographer makes his feature film directorial debut with this adaptation of Abbott's book.
I could really relate to so much of what she was writing about.
Durham says he and his brother also spent part of their childhoods with their gay father in San Francisco.
My dad had come out of the closet and he'd moved to the city in the mid-70s during the gay lib movement. So as a kid, I remember going to parties with my dad and his friends in San Francisco, and there was just this incredible mix of people, sort of the San Francisco blue-blooded society people mingling with the leather daddies and then the sort of Haight-Ashbury hippies and poets. It was really magical for me as a kid.
By the end of the 1980s, that exuberant freedom ended with the AIDS crisis, says Durham. Once again, he and Abbott had a similar experience as young adults. Both of their fathers were HIV positive and died of AIDS.
My dad died in 1992, the same year that Steve Abbott died. So Alicia and I were literally, though we hadn't met, we didn't know each other, we were both taking care of our sick fathers at the exact same time.
Durham notes that in 1992, HIV/AIDS was the leading cause of death for men aged 25 to 44.
It was really wiping out an entire generation. And we need to just keep reminding people that this happened and all these people we lost, especially in the creative community. There were so many incredibly talented people that we lost.
Abbott says she wants to remind people who read her memoir and watch the film that AIDS isn't over, that there are still people dying of the disease and people living with HIV as long-term survivors.
I do think that understanding and sharing this history is more important than ever, because I think especially young queer people feel that they're going through such a difficult time and trials, and to know where we've been and how as a community, the queer community stayed together and sort of persevered, I think it's really powerful. Like there's a long line of surviving and thriving through community that I believe is part of the story.
In Abbott's real-life Fairyland tale, the father dies, but not before encouraging his college-age daughter to become a writer. And now their story is on the big screen. Mandalit Del Barco, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
You're listening to People Powered KAXE and All Things Considered. Thanks so much for tuning in. I'm Jennifer Barr. In a few moments, our daily dose of phonology with John Latimer. Support comes from ICTV. ICTV connects, informs, and empowers the community through diverse media. Learn more at watchictv.org. Clear skies tonight, lows 37 to 44, and increasing clouds tomorrow, highs 62 to 66, winds from the south 10 to 15.
On today's date, October 8th, 2017, Jan from Warba, Minnesota reports seeing a last ruby-throated hummingbird. This is quite late in the season, and when I look back in my records, the average date for the last hummingbird to be seen in northern Minnesota is the 19th of September. The earliest was in 1984 and 2006 when I recorded my last hummingbird on the 4th of September. And in 2008, There was a hummingbird sighted on the 18th of October in 2010, on the 3rd of October, and then, of course, this note, which was on the 8th of October in 2017. These migrators are probably just the last ones to get the message that it's time to head south. So I guess the lesson to be taken here is, if you have a small hummingbird feeder, it might be wise to leave it up into October a little bit. You never know whose life you might be saving.
Our comes from this station and from CFP, Certified Financial Planner Professionals, committed to acting in their clients' best interests. Learn more at letsmakeaplan.org. From Amazon Business, offering business buying services, from office supplies to IT essentials and maintenance tools to help bring visions to life. Learn more at amazonbusiness.com. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. 2 years ago, Hezbollah started firing rockets into northern Israel from Lebanon. The attacks were in support of Hamas, which had attacked southern Israel from Gaza the day before. The conflict between Israel and Hezbollah left the militia's leadership decimated. And despite a ceasefire that came into effect almost a year ago, Israeli airstrikes and demolitions have erased entire neighborhoods of Lebanese villages and killed more than 300 people. NPR's Jaina Raff and Jawad Rizkullah traveled along the border in South Lebanon and found that Israel's military is ensuring Lebanese villagers do not move back.
We're in a cemetery in the Lebanese border village of Houla, in front of a marble monument now defaced and broken. The impact isn't as consequential as the demolished homes nearby, but it's a sign that the war officially frozen last year and the attempt to erase history still rages. Retired schoolteacher Abdulaziz Shreem tells us almost 100 people are buried here. They were killed in 1948 by Israeli officers, later tried for war crimes in what became known as the Houla massacre. He finds the names of his grandfather and grandmother on the damaged plaque. Israel and Hezbollah have been fighting across the Lebanese border since the Iran-backed militia started firing rockets at the beginning of the war in Gaza in 2023. Israeli attacks significantly weakened the militant group. After the ceasefire last November, when Hezbollah fighters withdrew from the border, Israeli soldiers occupied the village. They scrawled over the names with black spray paint and then smashed it in pieces. They left this message in Hebrew graffiti next to a Star of David. The only good Shia is a dead Shia. The Israelis took this entire village. They wanted to make the point that we are here. They wanted vengeance, Shreem says, the latest destruction. The Israeli military, in response to an NPR query, says after the desecration, it reinforced procedures, unspecified, to prevent such incidents in the future. Despite the U.S.-brokered ceasefire, UN peacekeepers say Israel has continued regular attacks in South Lebanon. In their latest six-month report issued in July, the peacekeeping mission recorded 440 Israeli attacks into Lebanon. It recorded just one by Hezbollah into Israel. In Houla, Shreem says Israeli military bulldozers leveled homes and rigged others with explosives. His was one of 55 houses the village mayor says Israel destroyed after the ceasefire. This was my house, Shreem says. It was a three-story home he built after years of working abroad. Now it's a mountain of rubble.
I'm looking at gauzy curtains that have been caught in a tree and they're floating with the wind among the leaves. Everywhere you look here, there are remnants of people's lives, almost all of it buried by chunks of concrete and metal bars.
Hey, dictionary.
Shreem, who's 74, pulls some loose pages from the rubble. He says losing his library is what hurts the most. He had about 1,000 books, philosophy, science, history, some irreplaceable. Nearby is a creased, faded postcard depicting the Virgin Mary, used as a bookmark.
Jésuit, juif, musulman.
I don't differentiate between Christian or Muslim or Jew, he says. The Zionists who killed his grandparents and destroyed his house, he says, are a different matter. Shreem says he used to harvest 200 pounds of pomegranates every season and sell the juice, but almost all the trees have been destroyed. It's dangerous here most days. Israel is still targeting what it says are Hezbollah fighters, and it drops stun grenades on civilians trying to rebuild. Resident Maryam Mizrani has come to take a quick look at what's left of her house. We are lost, she says. We need to know what will happen. Will our land be returned to us, or will they take it away from us? Will we be displaced again? The United States has floated turning these centuries-old villages into a Lebanese economic zone, it says, to help Israel feel secure. Shreem carries the keys to his demolished house, even though it no longer has walls or doors. He and his neighbors say they won't give up their homes, but neither can they rebuild while Israel is launching attacks. Jane Araf, NPR News, in Hula, southern Lebanon.
Today in Los Angeles, federal and local officials announced the arrest of a man in connection with January's Palisades fire. That fire destroyed over 6,000 structures and killed 12 people. Steve Futterman reports.
Today, almost exactly 9 months after the devastating Palisades fire, acting U.S. Attorney Bill Asaley got up in front of reporters at a press conference here in Los Angeles.
We are announcing the arrest of 29-year-old Jonathan Rindernecht for igniting a fire that ultimately burned down the Palisades.
Authorities accused the suspect of maliciously starting a different fire, called the Lockman Fire, in the early hours of January 1st. They say it was contained, but never completely extinguished.
Although firefighters suppressed the blaze, the fire continued to smolder and burn underground until on January 7th, heavy winds caused this underground fire to surface and spread above ground, causing what became known as the Palisades Fire.
According to the complaint filed in federal court, the suspect was working as an Uber driver at the time and lived in the Pacific Palisades area, though he has since moved to Florida. On New Year's Eve, the complaint says after Rindernecht dropped off a passenger in Pacific Palisades, he parked his car and walked up a nearby trail.
Took iPhone videos at a nearby hilltop and listened to a rap song whose music video included objects being lit on fire. The defendant had listened to this song and watched its music video repeatedly in the days leading up to the Lockman fire.
The complaint says cell phone data showed Rindernecht was mere feet from where the fire started at the time of its ignition. Environmental sensors in the area captured data and video of the fire in its early stages. Asaley said Rindernecht was the only one there at the time. He did not disclose a motive.
We're not going to get into motive right now because we're going to have to prove this case in court in front of a jury, and we don't want to get into that right now. More evidence will come out at trial, but we're not going to preview the entire case at this time.
Kenny Cooper with the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives says authorities processed hundreds of acres of fire damage, conducted hundreds of interviews, and collected more than 13,000 items of evidence as they investigated the case.
And I highlight this because I know there's questions on the length that it took us to come to this conclusion. But we were reviewing a lot of evidence from one of the most catastrophic fires in the U.S. history.
Rindernecht's first hearing was set for today in Florida, where he now lives. Court records did not immediately show his legal representation. For NPR News, I'm Steve Futterman in Los Angeles.
This is NPR News.
It is 4:29. You're listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. In just a few moments, national Native news, and 1 hour from now, it's the Up North Report, local news from our region. Programming is supported by Empty Bowls, fighting local hunger and building a stronger community with the Grand Rapids and Deer River Community Cafe. The event takes place Thursday, October 23rd at Timberlake Lodge from 11 to 2 and from 4 to 7. Tickets include soup and a locally made ceramic bowl. More info on Facebook at Itasca Empty Bowls Project. We thank Grand Itasca Clinic and Hospital for their support, home to an experienced OBGYN team that provides comprehensive women's health services, including maternity and advanced gynecology care, all in Grand Rapids. Learn more at granditasca.org. Mostly clear tonight, lows 37 to 44, and increasing clouds tomorrow, highs 62 to 66.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Arizona's 22 tribes rely on federal dollars to fund programs and even to pay some employees. But as KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio reports, two Valley-based tribal communities say the ongoing government shutdown should have limited effect.
Governor Stephen Rowe Lewis of the Gila River Indian Community shared in a video message that his administration has been crafting a contingency plan to fund essential services for up to 90 days. The longest shutdown was during President Trump's first term and lasted 35 days.
So our plan should more than cover a shutdown, but we will also have plans in place should a longer, unprecedented shutdown occur. And I also want to assure you that we don't anticipate any interruption in any of our community programs at this time.
That optimism was echoed in prepared remarks by Martin Javier, president of the neighboring Salt River Pima Maricopa Indian Community.
While this may cause some disruption, I want to reassure you that our tribal departments remain fully operational and staff are committed to delivering the services you count on every day.
Nearly 31,000 employees have been furloughed by the Interior Department, including more than a third of all Bureau of Indian Affairs staff. The National Congress of American Indians has even created a survey urging tribes across Indian country to share their experiences on how the current shutdown is impacting them. For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Pietrazio.
A new pitch competition is looking for indigenous entrepreneurs in Michigan who have ideas for startups. IPR's Claire Keenan-Kurgan has more.
IndigiPitch will give Native Americans in Michigan a chance to compete for cash prizes to get a startup off the ground. Shiloh Slumsky is the financial officer and tribal liaison for 20 Fathoms, a Traverse City-based group that's organizing the competition. She says Michigan's indigenous communities are full of creative business ideas.
You know, we're taught to not waste anything and to utilize everything that we take. And in order to utilize everything we take, it really takes an innovative mindset to be able to do that.
Slumsky is looking for applications from Native Americans in Michigan who have startup ideas and from Native small business owners who want to have a vendor booth at the event. It's on December 5th at the Ottawa Casino in Petoskey. Applications are open until October 13th. For National Native News, I'm Claire Keenan-Kurgan.
Chickasaw Nation Governor Bill Anitubby says the Chickasaw Nation is strong as he delivered the State of the Nation address.
Fellow Chickasaws, I'm honored to report to you today that the state of the Chickasaw Nation is remarkably strong and the best is yet to come.
He gave the speech during the Oklahoma Tribe's annual meeting and festival. Anitubby highlighted a number of tribal issues, including its diverse business portfolio, which he says continues to expand. He also touched on expanding education, healthcare, and other programs. Anitubby talked about the importance of collaboration, including for public safety and infrastructure projects.
By continuing government-to-government relations with local, tribal, state, and federal partners, and cultivating partnerships with agencies, institutions, and many other organizations, we assure mutual growth and vitality for the Chickasaw Nation and the communities throughout Oklahoma.
Anitubby emphasized the tribe's commitment to language and cultural preservation. The address was followed by a parade and activities, which are part of the week-long festival. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support by Sanofsky Chambers Law, championing tribal sovereignty and Native American rights since 1976, from opioids litigation to treaty rights to tribal self-governance, with offices in Washington, D.C., New Mexico, California, and Alaska. Sanofsky Chambers Law.
Support by Amerind, Indian Country's 100% tribally owned insurance partner. Information on property, liability, workers' compensation, and commercial auto needs at amerind.com.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from your part-time controller, specializing in nonprofit accounting and committed to supporting nonprofits with financial management services such as budgeting and forecasting, yptc.com/NPR. And from Fisher Investments, Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. The former director of the FBI appeared in court today as a criminal defendant. James Comey has pleaded not guilty to two felony charges, charges related to a media leak several years ago. Comey is one of several perceived enemies that President Trump has publicly urged his attorney general to prosecute. Now, Comey's lawyer says Comey is anxious to go to trial and to clear his name. NPR's Carrie Johnson was in the courtroom today. She's with me now. Hey, Carrie.
Hey there.
Okay, tell me more. Just what actually happened in court today?
Jim Comey was read his rights. He pleaded not guilty through his lawyer, and the judge released him with no bond and no conditions. For Comey, this must have been a surreal scene. He once worked as a federal prosecutor in Virginia. Now he was returning to the federal courthouse there as a person facing trial.
And did we get any sense? Did he show his hand at all in terms of how he intends to fight these charges?
Yeah, a bit. His lawyer is Patrick Fitzgerald, himself a legendary former national security prosecutor. Fitzgerald went out of his way to say at the start of the arraignment that it is the honor of my life to represent Jim Comey in this matter. He says Comey wants to go to trial, but they plan to file two big batches of court motions before then. The first will allege vindictive or selective prosecution, basically that President Trump improperly targeted Comey, who's one of Trump's longtime critics, and the defense may try to use Trump's social media posts and remarks about Comey to make their case. Remember, the president urged his Justice Department to hurry up and move along against Comey. Just as the statute of limitations was set to expire, the White House pushed out a longtime prosecutor who thought the evidence was weak and replaced that man with a member of Trump's inner circle with no experience. Her name is Lindsay Halligan. Comey says she was not legally appointed, so they're going to challenge the indictment on that basis as well.
Okay, so a little preview of the defense there. What about the government side of this? Was Lindsay Halligan there today?
She appeared in court, but she didn't say anything, and she's recruited two federal prosecutors from North Carolina to try this case, seemingly because no prosecutor in Virginia wanted to touch it. One of the North Carolina prosecutors is Nathaniel Lemons. He was a military lawyer. He's worked on national security. The other, Gabriel Diaz, has less experience. These DOJ lawyers say they're just wrapping their arms around all the information they're obliged to share with Comey. There's some classified material there, so that could turn into a sticking point down the road.
Carrie, you said this must have been a surreal scene for Jim Comey. What about for everybody else? Just take me inside the atmosphere at the courthouse today.
People lined up outside there before dawn, even though it was a very rainy morning. Some protesters held signs that said things like show trial and Trump is trashing the Constitution. Comey's the first perceived enemy of Trump to face criminal charges this year. But the president says there will be more. We also saw members of Comey's family, including his daughter Maureen, who was fired by the Justice Department this year. She's suing the DOJ to get her job back.
Okay, so next steps, where does this go from here?
This trial is going to take place in Alexandria, Virginia, a suburb of D.C. The court's known as the rocket docket for how fast things move. In fact, the arraignment started 5 minutes early. That never happens, but Judge Michael Nachmanoff said it was fitting. The judge directed both sides to meet and talk about any classified information in the case to try to avoid problems later. He said he would not tolerate delays. He set a trial date for January 5th of next year.
NPR's Carrie Johnson. Thanks, Carrie.
Thank you.
Germany's auto industry, once the backbone of Europe's biggest economy, is in rapid decline. In the past year, the industry shed more than 51,000 jobs. That is 7% of its workforce. NPR's Berlin correspondent Rob Schmitz reports some companies are now turning to manufacturing weapons to survive.
Bright yellow robotic arm carefully places freshly oiled bolts onto a blue plastic tray along an assembly line run by the Jopp Group, an automotive supplier in the town of Bad Neustadt in northern Bavaria. These types of robots are slowly replacing workers as more companies like Jopp throughout Germany's industrial heartland shed their human counterparts.
I think the automotive industry in Germany, but also in Europe, is in a bit of a crisis mode since maybe 5 years.
Jopp Group CEO Martin Buchs says inflation, tariffs, and competition from China have proven to be too much for Germany's once-dominant auto industry.
At peak times, we had 2,000 employees. Unfortunately, we had to cut 500, so now we have 1,500 employees.
He says that's still a sizable workforce for a German company like his, which assembles gear shift mechanisms for Ford, Porsche, and Mercedes-Benz. But all of this downsizing means that Buchs is looking to diversify what his company manufactures.
So we think it's very important for the German industry and for us to find new markets. And where are new markets? Well, government has committed a lot of new funding for defense. We are quite close to what defense industry needs. So it's very obvious for us to look to this market.
Buchs says Jopp is using its in-house injection molding and machining technologies to build military drones and unmanned vehicles. The company signed its first defense contract earlier this year.
If we don't want to reduce our labor force even more, we have to go into new industries. And the defense industry is a big potential.
It's a big potential for Sebastian Schulte, too. He's the CEO of Deutz AG, a company in Cologne whose founder invented the four-stroke combustion engine in the 19th century.
We also produced tractors, produced buses, we produced power plants, smaller power plants. So we were a pretty large company.
At its peak in the 1970s, Schulte says Deutz had nearly 40,000 employees. But in the past 20 years, the company's been reduced to just 3,000 workers in Germany who focus on building combustion engines for agricultural and industrial vehicles and equipment. But now, says Schulte, Deutz's business is picking up again, thanks to diversifying their business into building electric generators and building combustion engines for military vehicles. He says this transition is helped somewhat by German society's changing view on building military hardware after Russia's invasion of Ukraine 3 years ago.
The typical German industrial companies before 22, they tried to have nothing to do with defense. It was like, somewhere between gambling and other businesses which are not perceived as the most attractive one by society.
That has changed, says Schulte, and for Deutz it means building massive combustion engines for tanks and howitzer weapons. He says the requirements from his industrial clients are just as strict and demanding as those from his military clients, which equals a straightforward transition for his company. Karsten Brzezinski, an economist for ING, says the stories of both Deutz and Jopp are familiar ones in today's German economy.
It indeed is a sign of an industry that has been struggling now for a couple of years, that is also realizing gradually that competition out of China is here to stay. So this is a sector in severe transition with new competition. And if you are in this sector, of course, it is more than natural that you try to find other opportunity in order to keep your business running.
Brzezinski says there will certainly continue to be a fallout in Germany's automotive sector. But with hundreds of billions of dollars worth of new defense spending in the coming decade, he says many struggling companies would be keen to get in on all that new money put towards defending Europe. Rob Schmitz, NPR News, Bavaria.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It's 4:44. You're listening to People Powered KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. In just a moment, North Star Stories, produced by Ampers, stories from throughout Minnesota. Support comes from Rapids Brewing Company, a place for gathering and community, featuring live music multiple times a week, farm fresh food, and rotating beers from their own brew house. More information about their events, music, and menu at rapidsbrewingco.com. And we thank Boreal Brushworks Painting in Bemidji, providing full-service interior painting in residential locations throughout northern Minnesota, offering custom kitchen cabinet refinishing, as well as one-room or whole-house repainting. More information at borealbrushworkspainting.com. Clear tonight, lows 37 to 44, and increasing clouds tomorrow, highs 62 to 66, winds from the south 10 to 15. For Friday, mostly sunny, highs in the low to mid-60s with breezy north winds.
You are listening to North Star Stories, voices from where we live, a daily newscast about what it means to live in Minnesota.
In today's stories, a death at a daycare prompts a state investigation. Then, how a group of neighbors works to ensure the victims of the state's school and church shooting aren't forgotten. And why drivers need to be extra cautious this time of year. I'm Gracie J. The state of Minnesota has suspended the license of Rocking Horse Ranch Childcare in Savage, southwest of Minneapolis, after two infants suffered medical emergencies, including one fatality. The Department of Children, Youth, and Families called the situation, quote, an imminent risk of harm, and ordered the daycare to shut down immediately. Savage Police and the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension are investigating. The Hennepin County Medical Examiner is conducting an autopsy to determine the cause of the child's death. Next, after the recent mass shooting at Annunciation Catholic School in Minneapolis, a group of volunteers started tying ribbons onto trees around the school. Lydia Moran tells us how the project is spreading beyond grief.
Trying to get it so that when they're driving on 35W, they can see some of the blue and green.
On Wednesday, August 27th, a shooter opened fire during Annunciation Catholic School's first mass of the school year. Two children were killed, and 21 others were injured. In the following days, bows in Annunciation School colors popped up around the surrounding neighborhoods. People directly affected by the shooting requested bows on their blocks.
How do we kind of keep showing these neighbors that the love and support is still here?
Sarah Henning is picking at a knot in a bright green strip of plastic tablecloth. After freeing it, she joins the green strip with a blue one and loops them around a fence, tying a neat bow. Cars on the Minneapolis freeway below honk occasionally. She makes her way along the bridge, taking down bows that have gotten lackluster and retying them. The bows continue up 54th Street, tied to trees and light poles, all the way to Annunciation Catholic School.
There was a group of us who were all individually making ribbons and tying ribbons on trees to show our neighbors that we loved and supported them, and then giving them to other neighbors so they could do the same. So literally eight people were all doing the same thing, and then we all just came together.
On the Friday after the shooting, the group put out a call for volunteers to help cut and distribute ribbons. More than 200 people came. Since then, they estimate that they have distributed 30,000 ribbons throughout Minnesota and even in other states. The effort is called Bows of Love.
We also have people saying, what do ribbons even do? Which I get, right? Like, if tying a ribbon on a pole would reverse the impact of what happened, the city would be blanketed, because that's, I think, how Minnesotans are.
Sarah lives a couple miles from Annunciation.
But what it does do is it gives people something to do with their grief and their worry and their anxiety, and it gives them a simple way to show their neighbors, we are bigger than this terrible thing that happened, and we are still here.
The women hope that whatever the bows become, it will show Annunciation families that the support for them has not faded.
Knowing the impact of that immediate trauma, how can we act as quickly as possible to overwhelm that trauma with love.
In 2023, Sarah was part of the community that went through the Covenant School shooting in Nashville.
So that people understand there's space for both to exist right away.
For more on Bows of Love, visit bowsoflove.com or find them on Instagram at bowsoflove.mn. The Catholic Community Foundation of Minnesota has a centralized fund that supports Annunciation families. Visit ccf-mn.org to learn more. For North Star Stories, I'm Lydia Moran.
You are listening to North Star Stories. Well, it's harvest season, and the Minnesota Department of Transportation, also known as MnDOT, is urging drivers to stay alert for large farm equipment on rural roads. MnDOT says drivers should slow down, use headlights, and wait for safe passing zones. Farmers are reminded to use flashing lights and slow-moving vehicle emblems to stay visible. Officials stress that patience and caution can help everyone share the road safely this fall.
North Star Stories is produced by Ambers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, with support from the McKnight Foundation and the state of Minnesota, online at ambers.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. In his second term, President Trump has sent federal agents and National Guard troops to American cities in the name of cracking down on crime. In his first term, he dispatched federal law enforcement to Albuquerque, New Mexico, with the same stated goal. So what effect did that have, and what is the city doing these days to combat crime? NPR Justice correspondent Ryan Lucas reports.
In the summer of 2020, as the country was wrestling with the COVID-19 pandemic, President Trump's then-Attorney General William Barr announced a Justice Department operation to tackle the problem of soaring crime. Dubbed Operation Legend, the DOJ surged federal agents to 9 cities to help crack down on violent crime. One of those cities was Albuquerque, New Mexico.
Operation Legend made zero difference on crime in Albuquerque.
Tim Keller was the city's mayor then and is still the mayor now.
In fact, crime continued to go up both during and after Operation Legend. So by that measure, it was totally ineffective.
Around 24 federal agents were sent to Albuquerque as part of Operation Legend, which was led locally by the U.S. Attorney's Office. Over 5 months, some 170 defendants were charged with federal crimes in connection with the operation. Keller says the city and the Albuquerque Police Department did not take part because they saw it as an effort to target minorities for low-level crime. In his view, the operation was primarily a public relations stunt. But Keller doesn't dispute that crime has been a challenge for the city before, during, and after the pandemic.
Crime, basically in every category, was going up for 10 years.
But things have started moving in the right direction this year, he says.
So for the last 9 months, every single crime category in Albuquerque is going down by double digits.
That coincides in part with the deployment of some 90 New Mexico National Guard members to Albuquerque. But unlike in Washington, D.C. or Los Angeles, the Guard in Albuquerque hasn't been sent in by President Trump against the wishes of the mayor. Instead, New Mexico's Democratic governor, Michelle Lujan Grisham, dispatched them in coordination with the mayor's office and the local police department. Keller says they've been put to work in polo shirts instead of military fatigues, and they don't carry guns or have arrest powers. What they are doing is handling civilian work in the department, which frees up the actual police to tackle violent crime, he says.
They do a lot of traffic control, which, believe it or not, is very time-consuming for officers. They watch a lot of our cameras at the real-time crime center. They've actually saved lives by calling in folks who are in danger at bus stops. They also do monitor areas. So, for example, we have them ride our buses, and they just call in issues to APD.
It is an anti-crime mission that looks very different from how President Trump has employed the National Guard in Washington, D.C., where armed troops in camouflage patrol city streets, or in Los Angeles, where they have protected immigration agents. Keller says most of the guardsmen in Albuquerque live there, so they know the city already. And they've received training from the police department on things like de-escalation techniques and the communication system to help them do their job. Still, some members of the community have concerns about the Guard deployment. Dan Williams is with the ACLU of New Mexico.
We're very worried that even though it is different than what President Trump has done in Washington, D.C. and Memphis and other places, it normalizes the idea of the military doing civilian law enforcement.
Another is Matt Murarchy. He works for Enlace Comunitario, an organization that helps victims of domestic violence in immigrant communities.
We already have way too much over-policing here locally. We don't need additional National Guard troops
on the ground, it really is having an adverse effect on the health and well-being of community members, especially hyper-marginalized community members like our client community.
Keller acknowledges that the response from residents has been mixed and that using the guard is a short-term solution to a longer-term problem. He also says the way the city has employed the guard is an alternative to how it's been used by the Trump administration, but he says the Albuquerque model may not be replicable everywhere. It takes the governor, the mayor, and the police department all to be on the same page, which isn't always easy. But for now, he says it's been of help in Albuquerque. Ryan Lucas, NPR News, Washington.
Winners of the so-called genius grants have been announced. 22 individuals have received MacArthur Fellowships, $800,000 each, no strings attached. The MacArthur Foundation is a financial supporter of NPR's. This year's fellows include an astrophysicist, a cartographer, an archaeologist. You can see the whole list at NPR.org. Elizabeth Blair reports on some of the artists who were selected.
Jeremy Frey is an artist who weaves elaborate, intricately patterned baskets by hand, a tradition that's been in his family's Passamaquoddy tribe for generations. He lives in the Maine woods.
I'm out at my annual moose harvest. The leaves are all bright.
The MacArthur Foundation had trouble reaching him to let him know he'd won the fellowship.
My phone blocks numbers that I don't know. So someone was calling me all day. I didn't know who it was. And finally, they left a message saying who the organization was.
Frey still can't believe he's been awarded $800,000 for his work. His baskets are all made of natural materials, like black ash and sweet grass. He's still figuring out what he'll do with the money.
It helps me really think that what I'm doing and the path I'm on is the right path.
Other artists among this year's MacArthur Fellows are novelist Tommy Orange, jazz improviser and composer Craig Taborn, and singer, playwright, and composer Heather Christian.
I will remind you, you will continue to choose wrong. You will continue to be hurt and to hurt others.
The nominations and vetting process for fellows can take months, sometimes years, says the MacArthur Foundation's Marlies Carruth. She says MacArthur Fellows are thinkers, dreamers, and doers.
There's a tenacious aspect to their work.
MacArthur Fellow Tanika Lewis Johnson is based in Chicago.
My work uses art, storytelling, and community organizing to help the larger public learn about and confront the history of segregation, housing injustice, and the ways in which Black neighborhoods have been devalued.
Johnson's Folded Map project compares homes with the same addresses on the same streets, but on completely different sides of town, like 6720 North Ashland and 6720 South Ashland. Because of history, one of those families is likely white, the other Black. She brings these map twins together to talk about the contrasts and similarities between life on each side. Johnson says her community has nurtured her work.
You know, the fellowship has my name on it, but it really belongs to my neighborhood, Inglewood, a South Side, predominantly Black community that has often been dismissed. And now this recognition proves that my neighborhood, too, despite what it's been through, is a place where brilliance occurs, where geniuses exist.
Tanika Lewis Johnson says the MacArthur Fellowship will allow her to keep doing what she's doing with stability. Elizabeth Blair, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Easy Cater, a business tool for food designed to help organizations order food for meetings and events from restaurants nationwide, set up employee lunch programs, and manage food spend at easycater.com. From Procter & Gamble, maker of ZzzQuil, with a range of products designed to relieve occasional sleeplessness to help people fall asleep. Learn more at ZzzQuil.com. From the Cy Sims Foundation, since 1985, supporting advances in science, education, and the arts towards a fairer, more just, and civil society. More information is available at cysimsfoundation.org. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
It's a minute before 5 o'clock. Thanks for listening to 91.7 KAXC Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXC Bagley, Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. We are People Powered Radio in Northern Minnesota. You can join us at KAXC.org. I'm Jennifer Barr. Stay tuned for another hour of All Things Considered, including the Up North Report, local news from our region at 5:30. 6 o'clock news from a Canadian perspective with the CBC on As It Happens. And 7 o'clock tonight, Alyssa Allen, your volunteer host for On the River. Support comes from the Timberlake Restaurant in Grand Rapids, featuring martini Monday each week from 5 to 8. More information at TimberlakeLodgeHotel.com. Mostly clear tonight, lows 37.